I'm very happy to be here. My first disclaimer is I'm not a lawyer, and grade me on the curve. Going to talk a little bit about...
have to be here. My bias is that I fail to see the rationale for copyright law getting in the way.
I'll be doing that at some point, but you know about this, and it's in the U.S. Constitution. Royalties are a good thing, very good thing, because without them, musicians are like a barber. You give somebody a haircut, you get $20, $30, they go away. You're limited by the amount of money you can make by the number of haircuts that you do. Now, you could make more if you added another chair or two in the beauty shop there and charged a certain, you know, percentage of rent for some other people, but you're, you know, without royalties, you're kind of stuck. The good thing about royalties is you do something once, and it can keep paying over and over. And so it's like a fruit tree. You know, the fruit tree might be kind of small to begin with, but if you get an orchard going, you can do pretty well. So it's an important thing, I think. Now, there are also other royalties that are available. I'm going to talk mainly about composers, but royalties are available to musicians when you play on a certain, commercial, those kinds of things. There are some repayments that happen. In fact, they can be pretty lucrative too, but I won't really go into those. So one of the big ones is print rights. And these are, you write some music and or a book or, a study book or something, and you go to your publisher and you say, I want you to distribute it, and they do, and you set up a royalty agreement with them, and you assign your copyright to them, and then they manufacture and promote it, they publish it. And so they have the exclusive right to do this. And they sell it in stores or online at usually a 40 to 60% reduction. And out of that, for music books, the creator of the music book usually gets 10% of the retail price, which is a good thing. We have mechanical rights. On this, you have to think about the Harry Fox Agency, because they're the major entity that collects mechanicals. But the term mechanical rights came from the period when there were player pianos. So the music is created mechanically and not with a human right there, other than pumping the pedals in the case of the piano rolls. So they're delivered without live performers. And if you want to record and distribute a song, you have to get a mechanical license for it. But the catch is, if it's previously recorded, you don't even have to ask. You pay the statutory rate. And that is, set by Harry Fox in negotiations, I suppose, with others. But right now, it's 9.10 cents for pieces less than 5 minutes, and 1.75 cents for pieces longer than 5 minutes. So you see, if you've got a CD with 10 compositions on it, and if you own them, you're going to collect 91 cents, 91 and a half cents on each CD sold. Those are just the mechanicals. And if you're Michael Jackson and you sell a couple million of these things, it's big money. So even a million seller, you'll get whatever that is, $91,000. So mechanicals are really coveted, and you really have to be careful with them and not give them up. So, Harry Fox Agency collects these funds, and then they send them to the publisher, and then the publisher divides them between the publisher and the author, Now, you can be the author could also be the publisher, okay? But the big record labels, and this is changing a little bit now because of the way the that kind of industry has changed, but the big labels would often say, okay, I'll take your, we will take your your works and we will put them out, we'll, you know, put them out on the market, but we want half of the publishing, okay? You're the publisher of this, but we don't care. We want half of it. Or maybe they even, if they really drive a hard bargain, they may say, we want all of it. So musicians would give up their, you know, if they really want to get with a big label, they would give, surrender some of their publishing rights. They'd try to keep the writing rights, you know, the author rights, but surrender the publishing rights. So you can see there's kind of serious money involved in this thing, and I already gave you the example about 10 works on a CD is about $91,000 if you sell a million. The other thing is that if a song is very popular, it can be recorded many, many, many times, and this will happen all over again. Once, actually it was quite a long ago, it was around 1980, a publisher asked me to write, to do some, an improv series, and they said, you can use any, you know, use any of the tunes here in our catalog. So one was Jerome Kern. And because of this, I said, well, I want to have a discography in this. Just tell me how many times it's been recorded. All the things you are, I hope some of you still remember that one. All the things you are had recorded, been recorded at that time more than 600 times. That's a lot. Let's say that you only put out 1,000. If you only sold 1,000 CDs, you know, it comes out to something like, you know, 5.4 million. And you know, some of those things were recorded many, many times and sold for, they sold many CDs, okay? So a tune like that is really a little money tree. And you may remember the Michael Jackson, I think it was the Associated Television Corporation, ATV. Their catalog came up for sale, and within it was Beatles tunes. Not all the Beatles tunes, but really a lot of them. And at that time, Michael Jackson bought it for something like $45 or $47 million. You know, that's, they have actual people that value these catalogs. You know, you're going to get a lot of them that are obscure, but some of the really gold mines in there, in this catalog, you're going to are going to be very valuable. So he was up against Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney didn't prevail in that. He must have stopped at 46 million or something in the bidding war, okay? But you don't have to feel too bad about Paul McCartney because, of course, he and John Lennon have the writing rights on those, so they're getting half of it. So mechanicals are a big thing. You have performance rights. And in 1897, there was an amendment to the copyright law that provided that the copyright holder should be paid for their performers. But there was no way to collect this. But fortunately, there was an example in France of about, I don't think, around 1850 or 1851, that they had an entity that would collect these performance rights. So trying to figure out how to collect the money when the country's a big country and the world is even bigger, how are you going to get your money when somebody performs your piece? You can't be every place. So ASCAP was founded, and it was founded mainly from the influence of Puccini, who came here to have an opera performed, and he found out, hey, there's no performance rights provision here, we got to do something. So they got together with John Philip Sousa, and I think Jerome Kern was in on that, and Irving Berlin maybe too, influential people at the time, and set up ASCAP. Now there are other entities, not just ASCAP, there's BMI, which is founded, I don't know, in 1950 or something like that. 1941 or 40 on the nose. Okay. So BMI was founded by radio owners who said, you know, why should we pay ASCAP? Let's set up our own performance rights thing. We will monitor these things, and we'll still pay the, you know, the royalties that they should get, but we will monitor this thing. So how do you get your money? You can have ASCAP or another agency collect these funds on your behalf, but of course they can't be every place either. And so what they do is they issue blanket licenses. And there's probably a license for this hotel. This hotel probably pays a blanket to ASCAP. I know at Eastman we have a, you know, it's not even that much. Maybe it's because it's educational, but it's about $1,000, I think, is all we pay per year. And we have, you know, probably 1,000 concerts that are played in that place over a year's time. But anyway, ASCAP has about 170 of these different kinds of licenses. And CSAC has them too. And of course, if, they also have field agents who monitor these things. And if your piece gets played in Des Moines at midnight on a weekday, it's probably going to be worth quite a lot on there because, you know, it just got picked up if it gets played and monitored, okay? So you get a little bit out of that. But if you have a piece that's on, you know, like The Tonight Show, the old Johnny Carson show that's played every single night, it is worth an awful lot. I think I remember hearing that just that theme for The Tonight Show was about $250 per night. So added up, it gets big. That's why also the most lucrative thing to do is to write the theme for a show on television, because the theme is where you get the money. And that's why you see, you know, music theme by what's his name, Post. Can't think of his first. Yeah, Mike Post, okay. And then after that, somebody else does the usual writing of the music for the episodes. So, sync rights. These was in the early days of film. It's the music synchronized to film, and now it includes commercials, karaoke, music boxes. I just put the two, you know, sort of off the wall ones, karaoke and music boxes, in there. And these are negotiated directly with the copyright holder, and it's not for the novice to try to do by yourself. Unless, I mean, we did it at Eastman. We had a piece that we wanted to use on a little, we call it a commercial, but it's a sort of an ad for our career services. And so we made this thing up, and we went and asked the copyright holders permission, because at Eastman we don't want to be messing up, and also we don't want to be taking money out of any musician's pocket. So anyway, they granted it. They just said, sure, go ahead and do it. You know, you're not making money on this. They didn't charge us anything. So it's a couple different ways on these sync rights. If you create a new version, you have to get a sync license. But if you use somebody's version, then you have to also get a master recording license. So there's two things on that kind of thing. With this little background, now we get to some illegal downloads. Now I Google my name. It's sort of a standing order I have with Google, just to see what's going on. You know, where are things being, where's my name coming up? I mean, people do this all the time. The Eastman School of Music does it too, so that they can say, oh, we have a graduate who won a Pulitzer, okay, that kind of thing. So I know of 9 sites that have my music that you can get, or my books or music that you can get and download for free. And those are just 3 of them. Unfortunately, they didn't come out very well, so you can't see it too well. But the first one here, this is called idownloadgalore.com. Now up here, let's see, here we go. Download count, 19,925 downloads, okay? It's almost 20,000 downloads. That particular book, well, I can't tell what book that is because RAR is some sort of package, zip file or something. I don't know exactly, but that means there was probably a couple of them in there. But let's take this one here with, 19,803. It's a book I wrote in 1975. We out of time?
If you want to use this while you're...
Oh, I'm okay. So, 19,803. Let's round it off and say 20,000. The book cost $17. That's $340,000 that the publisher didn't get, okay? And that's $34,000 that I didn't get. And there are a bunch of others. That's one I did with Walt Weisskopf, famous tenor saxophonist, published by Jamie Abersold. Again, 19,864. These numbers are all kind of close, so I'm thinking that they go on this download thing and they just bam, bam, bam. They just click them and package them up and they come. So you can see, we thought the photocopy machine was tough. This is unbelievable, you know. Here's another one. This is a little less. Now, I only put the ones up that actually brag about the number of downloads. You know, some of them don't brag about the downloads. This one here, 9,000. Okay, you get the point, you know. You get the point. But this one right here, this person happens to be my son-in-law. I didn't even know he was doing this till about a year ago. He's an amateur guitarist. He used to play in high school and college, but he doesn't like the smoke. He doesn't like the late hours. He doesn't like schlepping the amplifiers around. So he doesn't play out. But what he does, he's created a website where he plays along with the track, and he gives a guitar lesson. And it's cut in such a way that shows his hands, okay? And he's got a guitar collection, and he plays them on the right guitars, and he cranks these things out. He's very good, he's got a good ear. Thing is, he doesn't even read music. So right now you see uploaded videos, he's got 1,143. The people that subscribe, 18,458, and he's now over 16 million views. 16,113,739. He gets about 25,000 views per day. Now, he's not making any money on it. He doesn't charge, he doesn't have any ads. This is like an educational thing. And it started when his brother said, hey, could you show me how to play something or other? And Chris said, okay, well, I could talk you through it, but I'll just record it and I'll put it up on YouTube and you can look at it. And then some other people started downloading it and he said, hey, this is kind of fun. I think I'll go this way. So I don't think he's unique. You know, there are other people doing these kinds of things, but I'm telling you, I think he told me it took about a year to get 1 million views, but this thing is going geometrically now. It just keeps bigger and bigger and bigger. So I want to show you what he does, and we'll see if this works. You want to shift to the other thing?
Yeah.
I'm just going to play a little bit of this. Pause it for a second and I'll hit it.
Oh, there we go. Hey, before we get going on it.
So what he does, some of them he actually explains what the deal is. He explains, I didn't know this, but many of these guys retune their guitars to make it easier to reach certain chords. And the one he's going to show, he explains how it's been retuned, okay? Because some of the things they call it detuning, okay? And he's got a great ear that allows him to hear that. And because if you're trying to learn some tune off the record, you could be goofing around and say, why is this so hard? I can't reach it. How did he do that? So he's figured this out. And this particular one is a thing that it's a Joni Mitchell tune. And I figured you'd like that. There's a lot of rock and roll ones here that might kind of hit you over the head. So
going on this one, I'll just explain the tuning on it. It goes C, G, D, F, C, E. So it sounds like this. This is kind of a typical, unusual Joni Mitchell tuning, but one at a time, they're like this. C, G, D, F, C, E. Kind of jazz sounding. Well, it is jazz, I guess. Jaco Pastorius is on bass, so it must be jazz, right? But we'll give it a whirl and see what happens.
I'm playing this so that you can just hear that he plays along with the track. Okay, so you get the idea. He plays along with the track. The track is way, way down. It's mainly him, you know, mainly him that you hear playing the guitar. And it's just a visual kind of thing. Now, he ran into a little bit of trouble with Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven. They didn't like that. So what he did, he put on headphones and just played with Led Zeppelin through the headphones, and you don't even hear the music going there. The other problem he had was Jimi Hendrix. He opened his computer one day, and big red thing flashing or staring, and he was, you know, cease and desist, take this down, Jimi Hendrix estate. Some of these guys are, or their estates are, very strict about this kind of thing, but most of them like the advertisement that it gives them. Because let's think about this. If this Joni Mitchell, if these kids learn how to play this particular thing, they're going to play it at wherever they do, on their gigs, those kinds of things. It could get monitored, could get picked up. ASCAP royalties come back that way. So it's sort of like advertising. And but you can argue the other way, too, that's for sure. And the copyright law, he says some of these things, someone will write from a, you know, there's sort of a social net, social kind of thing going on here too, because people write to him and they talk and they say, hey, yeah, great, you did a great job on that. How about doing this and that, such and such next? But anyway, they'll write and say, hey, we're here in Germany and we didn't get this. We can't hear it. We can see you playing, but there's no audio. Those kinds of things. So he actually thought, you know, YouTube's going to shut him down, but he, you know, no money is involved in this thing, and if he could just figure that out, it would be pretty good. But he'd have to be like a barber and start giving lessons over Skype or something, you know, and so. Anyway, I think that was a pretty creative thing. That's pretty much what I have to say, except blatant commercialization here. I have a book that I have out. Lessons from a Streetwise Professor, What You Won't Learn in Most Music Schools. I'm the Streetwise Professor because I have been a professor at Eastman for 41 years on the faculty and also done all kinds of recordings and those kinds of situations and lots of publications. So, and I actually won an award. That's why that is a little badge there. You know, best books. I don't know if it was a vanity thing or not, but there were a lot of people that entered, and this won in a second place, the equivalent of second place in a business category. So, any questions? I could just add one other little quick story about, we did this, did a recording for it was back in 1980, for NBC and the Olympics. And it was on a program called The Road to Moscow. And you'll remember the Olympics didn't happen for us then. So anyway, the piece did get played, and it was, you know, the theme was played a lot on this show, Road to Moscow. Okay, so then things are over. There's no Road to Moscow, so that's the end of that. So the World Series came up in October, and I'm sitting watching the game, and I hear this NBC theme. I say, man, you know, we've been paid for this once, but, you know, it's a 13-week thing, and we're on a new cycle now. So we all started, everybody was on this particular thing, the composer and myself, I was a contractor. We started watching NBC Sports a lot just to see what was happening. So they even started using it on the golf program, because there was a whole bunch of different versions, sort of a hot version, and there was sort of a subdued version, and they would play it on golf. So we went to NBC and told them what it was, you know, and said when it was performed and all that stuff, but it didn't hold up because they said, well, you know, we didn't have a recording of it. You just didn't do that back then. You couldn't do that, okay? But what we could do, we waited until the ASCAP came to the composer of this. And ASCAP had picked this up because it was on network TV, and he had, you know, made a certain amount of money, and that proved that the musicians, you know, that they were using this work that we had recorded, you know, in, you know, 9 months earlier. So we prevailed in that, and they didn't even argue with us or anything. They gave us $14,000, and that was pretty good. So there's a question back there. Yeah.
I'm curious about the what the Jimi Hendrix estate threatened to do to your son-in-law, because just yesterday I was talking to one of our professors at Chapel Hill who has written a music history text, and he tried to get permission for the Jimi Hendrix Star Spangled Banner, and they objected to the fact that he referred to Hendrix's drug use in his history. And they wanted all references to Hendrix's drug use expunged from this history. And so in this sense, it's almost not fair use they're talking about. It's trying to control the image of the artist that they're supposedly protecting. And I'm just curious what they threatened to do to your son-in-law.
Well, it was just a cease and desist. Just take it down. Yeah. Yeah. Now, did they want to have a sound clip of the Star Spangled Banner?
Yeah, he wanted to use that in the CD portion of with the music history text,
okay.
And they just refused to allow any permission for that, and especially objected to, and that was one of the reasons why, because he referred to drug use in relation to Hendrix.
Anything else? Yes, sir.
I'm just flabbergasted that not necessarily the performers at the, you know, knowing Joni, she would, you know, I know she would appreciate this type of thing. I used to record her back in the 60s before she started making her first records, and she said she didn't care that she had recordings at college stations all over the country. She didn't care if she ever did start making recordings. But I'm surprised that the record companies haven't come after him for all this, because, you know, knowing what I've heard about people being asked to take down stuff on YouTube, that they allow this. Do you think it is possibly because there is an educational factor in this, and that is fair use?
Well, that's what I learned in one of the first speaker. Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. And also, he's not trying to make money. Okay. Yeah. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray.